All right, let's get started. This is Ezra Class 3. We had our introduction that was like 35 minutes long. Then we had last week, which if you were with us or you watched that video, you knew it was a challenge, not only because it was a difficult kind of way to set up the text, but the actual text itself was somewhat laborious, right? The names of infamy that are there. That's definitely a challenge to teach publicly, which is why, you know, you tend to avoid it. But hopefully you were able to keep up with that and figure out why we had to read all that together. So this week we get to go to the actual good part of the text when it comes to teaching, because it's kind of the one that people go to very often to talk about how to overcome adversity. That's one theme I've seen. So I want to remind us that we are in the book of Ezra. This is chapter 3. We're going to chapter 4 this week. I actually remembered to bring my iPad today, and so I can have the slide or the box here that has the actual text, so you can follow along with that if you're able. Again, if it's too small for you to read, I can't make it any bigger without cutting off video of me actually teaching it. So anyway, if you want to follow along in your own Bible at home, that's fine. Again, Ezra chapter 3, I want to read verse 12 and 13 again to kind of allow us to see the flow of the text. And the author writes, "But many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first house," talking about the temple, "wept with a loud voice when they saw the foundation of this house being laid, though many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the joyful shout from the sound of the people's weeping, because the people shouted with a great shout and the sound was heard far away." So you got this generational thing where if you were a young boy that was taken in during captivity and you saw the old temple that Solomon built, and then you saw it go up in flames and all these things destroyed, and then 70 years later you're an old man and you get to see the foundation of the temple being laid, but it was not quite the same. You got folks crying, you got folks shouting for joy, and they kind of blend together in this kind of sad but beautiful and joyous moment, and then you've got people far away that can hear what's going on in Jerusalem. So an interesting time in the history of the Jews, but it was not without opposition. You had folks that had moved in or retaken or taken back the land of Canaan when Israel was taken away captive, right? I've mentioned in the introduction and the one last week as well that this is where that kind of Samaritan situation came up that was going to be around up until, you know, John chapter 4. You've got this group of people that had the Pentateuch, the first five books of the law, the Torah, but they also had some more stuff they added to it, so they call it the Samaritan Bible. And part of that was they were to worship on the mountain of Samaria instead of in Jerusalem. That was done for practical purposes because Jerusalem didn't have a temple anymore. And so if you wanted to be kind of a Jew and you were from this blended tribe of people that were from Canaan, but you were kind of Jewish in a way, but you were Samaritan, then you would worship on Mount Samaria, or the mountain that was in Samaria. And so that's kind of one thing that's there. You have people that are not the people that were taken captive who are there in this area when they retake the area from King Cyrus of Persia's decree. So chapter 4, this is where you get kind of an introduction to the enemies here. Chapter 4, verse 1. "Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin," so the southern tribes, "heard that the returned exiles were building a temple to the Lord, the God of Israel, they approached Zerubbabel," so one of the governors, "and the heads of the fathers' houses, and said to them, 'Let us build with you, because we worship your God as you do, and we have been sacrificing to him ever since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here.'" So this is where you kind of get that blended influence, right? They recognize Jehovah or Yahweh as the Lord. And they've been worshiping, but they've been doing it incorrectly because they don't have the temple, they don't have the altar, they don't have the priesthood. So you have this kind of mixed interest, right? But Zerubbabel, Jeshua, or Joshua, and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses in Israel said to them, "You have nothing to do with us in building a house to our God, but we alone will build to the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." So they draw a very hard line and they say, listen, no, we're doing this. We're the Jews. We're the remnant. We're the ones prophesied about coming back and restoring the temple. You can't help us here. You can't join us. That's interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, they kind of were idol worshipers, right? Keep that in mind here. They came from Assyria. They didn't come from, you know, Israel or Philistia or any other area. They came from Assyria, and they recognized Jehovah God as maybe the local tribal god of this area that they were given by the king that sent them that down here from Assyria back in the day. They could have had other gods, other deities. Also, they could have just worshipped Jehovah, but been doing it incorrectly based on what they were taught when they were placed in this land before the north was taken away. So a lot of history here. I'm sure archaeology has a lot to say about it, but for practical purposes here, the Jews were rejecting a form of idolatry or religious worship that even talked about the right God, because they were so clear that the message God was trying to give them by sending them away for 70 years was, you are to worship Jehovah God and Him alone in the way that He prescribed in the law. So when they came back, they were not going to let this group of non-Jews that were not living faithfully worship with them, because they didn't want to repeat the mistakes of the past. That's good. It's a good thing, obviously. What's the application for us? Well, I don't know. There's a bunch. We know a lot of individuals that worship the same creator that we do, and they do very different things than we do. And whether or not what they do is right or their intention is right, I think it's clear from applications like this that we have to be very selective in with whom we work and we worship and we serve, because not everyone who claims the name Christian is going to make it with God for eternity. So you know, even among people in our number, in our name, if you will, there are some folks that are not going to make it. And so at least, at the very least, what I will say with some kind of certainty is we have to be mindful of that temptation and be aware of it and watch out for it. Okay, verse 4. Then the people of the land, so the blended group, if you will, discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to build, and bribed counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, who Xerxes II, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. So let's pause here and make this comment. So you got a group of folks here that's saying they want to help with the work. They want to contribute to the building of the temple to the Lord, the God of Israel. So they knew who He was. They knew what they were doing. And they wanted to help. The people that came back from exile, they could not accept that help. And so what do the people who claim to be God worshipers or God fearers do? They begin to discourage those that are trying to do the right thing. Now, I know you can probably look into your own life and see situations in which you're trying to do the right thing and someone offers some help and you say no, and then they begin to be a thorn in your side from that day forward. If Howard were here, I'm sure he'd talk about some stories that he has when it comes to people he's tried to help and be kind to, and they were unkind to him in return. It's kind of like that here. You got the people who really have no claim on this land or this religious ceremony because they're not even from Persia. The guy in control of this land is Cyrus the First, who is king of, or emperor, if you will, of the Medo-Persian Empire. And so if he is the one that said, yeah, you guys can go back and you can rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, rebuild the walls later in Nehemiah, I will fund part of it, I will give you back the stuff for the temple, he's the one that made the call, and they were trying to cause issues the entire time. Again, what they do, they discourage the people of Judah, so they, you know, they weren't friends anymore. They made them afraid to build, so they were threatening them physically with violence. And they were bribing counselors, or you might say government officials, to make their life more difficult through the red tape that was there. And that kept going for, you know, what, 100 years between these two kings, or three kings? So, by the way, verse 6, in the reign of Ahasuerus, that name should be somewhat familiar to you. From what I understand, Natasha taught Esther. Is that the right book? So that should be a pretty clear name for you when it comes to that class, if you were in that lady's class. Verse 7, for example, here is a letter. In the days of Artaxerxes, Bishlam and Mithridesh, great names, and Tabeel and the rest of their associates wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And the letter was written in Aramaic and translated. This is kind of where you get the beginning of Aramaic language, which is the language that Jesus would have been speaking commonly. The Sermon on the Mount, for example, would have been verbally told in Aramaic and then written later in Greek by Matthew and Mark and Luke. So there you go. Verse 8, Rehum the commander in Shimshai, which is a great, it's one of my favorite names. The scribe wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes the king as follows. Rehum the commander, Shimshai the scribe, and the rest of the associates, the judges, the governors, the officials, the Persians, the men of Erech, the Babylonians, the men of Susa, that is, of the Elamites, and the rest of the nations whom the great and noble Anasapar deported and settled in the cities of Samaria and the rest of the province beyond the river. So they're saying all of us, verse minus the Jews. This is a copy of the letter they sent to Artaxerxes the king. Your servants, the men of the province beyond the river, send greeting. And now be it known to the king that the Jews who came up from you to us have gone to Jerusalem, and they are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They are finishing the walls and repairing the foundations. Now be it known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and the walls are finished, they will not pay tribute, custom, or toll, and the royal revenue will be impaired. So their big threat is these guys that, you know, your grandfather sent down here, or father sent down here to rebuild the temple, you might want to review that, because they're rebuilding it, and as soon as they do, you're not going to have any tax money from them at all. Although you should be taking taxes from them as the emperor, you're not going to get any. Verse 14. Now, because we eat the salt of the palace, it is not fitting for us to witness the king's dishonor. So he's saying, because you support us so much, it's like we're dining at your table, we want to tell you the truth. Therefore, we send and inform the king, in order that the search may be made into the book of the records of your fathers, and you will find in the book of the records and learn that this city is a rebellious city, hurtful to kings and provinces, and that sedition was stirred up in it from of old. That is why this city was laid waste, as if he doesn't already know. Anyway, verse 16, we make known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls finished, you will then have no possession in the province beyond the river. So that's the letter, right? If you're just getting that and you're the emperor, you're the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, and you hear that there is a group of people rebuilding a famous city of old that was so hard to capture and to conquer that when it's rebuilt, they're going to secede from you and they're going to be their own independent nation again, and you're not going to get any more tribute or taxes from them, that's, of course, cause for alarm or concern. The problem is it's just not true, right? There is a lot more history in here of which I'm not aware. I'm still learning about it because it's a period of time that was not really taught to me before. I had to kind of learn it myself. And then the more I learn about it, the more questions I have. But there are the book of 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And then you have the apocryphal 3rd and 4th Maccabees that are kind of written in there. history books about the time between Malachi and Matthew, so those 400 years of Maccabean rebellion against the guy who was in control of this area under Alexander the Great's command, the Seleucids. And so it's a complicated history there that I can't really explain well. But I will say that that's kind of what happens up until Matthew, is you've got this group of Jews who want to just go back to the way things were and not be controlled by a foreign empire. But they went from basically Assyria to Babylon to the Medo-Persian Empire to the Macedonian Empire through Alexander the Great. And then they were controlled by his kind of generals, right? And then it goes to Rome takes over and just takes all of the, that fragmentary rule from the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Judea, and they kind of just make it all Roman. And then when you have Christ appear, they're in control of the Roman Empire. That's not already a fact that you know. So they never really get their freedom again. And in fact, in AD 70 after Christ, the temple that we're reading about here, which was kind of rebuilt by Herod when he got control in the first century, that's destroyed too. It is burnt to the ground on all the records that go along with it. So there's a bird's eye view of all that. So here's the letter in response. Verse 17. The king sent an answer to Rehum the commander and Shimshah, there's our guy, the scribe, and the rest of their associates who live in Samaria, and in the rest of the province of beyond the river, greeting. And now the letter that you have sent to us has been plainly read before me, and I make a decree. A search has been made, and it has been found in this city from of old has risen against kings, and that rebellion and sedition have been made in it. And mighty kings have been over Jerusalem, who rule the whole province beyond the river, to whom tribute, custom, and toll were paid. Therefore, make a decree that these men be made to cease, that the city not be rebuilt until the decree is made by me. And take care not to be slack in this matter. Why should damage grow to the hurt of the king? So he's like, all right, let me investigate. Until I figure out what's going on here, I'm going to go ahead and pause the continuation of the rebuilding of the city. Verse 23, then when the copy of the king Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their associates, they went in haste to the Jews at Jerusalem and by force and power made them cease. So they got their way, right? Is what they did good? Obviously not. They were sent there by God and by Cyrus to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, because that needed to be the place from which the Christ would have certain things that he would have to do. And the gospel, the good news, would go forth from Jerusalem and then to Judea and to Samaria and then to all throughout the world, right? So if there's no Jerusalem for him to go and do these things in as prophesied, that's going to be a problem. So that's the whole point. Verse 24. Then the work on the house of God that's in Jerusalem stopped, and it ceased until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. By the way, the name there, Darius, we would say with our American accent, every other person who knows this language has called it Darius. So I've forced myself to say Darius. So there you go. Chapter 5. So we have the restoration of some of the parts that made Israel and the law fit, right? So I always mention this because I want you to be clear about how it used to work, is you have God at the top who gives the directives and wants to bless the people, and he wants that relationship where they are his people and he is their God. That's what he wants. So you have God at the top, and he communicates to the Israel through prophets mainly. Either prophets who wrote down the material by inspiration, or the prophets who lived in that generation and he used them to speak inspiration or in an inspired way. And then you have the people of Israel responding to God by offering sacrifices and celebrating the feast days or festivals to remember their heritage. And so that kind of completed the circle of communication between God and Israel. So we've had the restoration of the altar and the foundation and the walls being put up for the temple. So they're able to do the cleansing rituals, as we read in chapter 2. They're able to offer certain sacrifices like they were told to do every year, then even every day for that matter, on the altar. And then they were able to celebrate the Feast of Booths, right, or Tabernacle, so living in tents to remember how they got there in the first place. So that part of the equation has been restarted. But you still don't really have a whole lot of prophets from God speaking up during this time. We know a lot about those that were writing while they were away in exile, but there are a couple, and this is going to be clear pretty soon who they were, who are going to be helping give direction from God to the people directly through prophets on what they were to do and when and so on. So here's that. Chapter 5, verse 1. Now the prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, son of Iddo, so you pause there and you see those two names. Those are minor prophets because their books that we have preserved are smaller than the major prophets, right? And we've actually gone through those fairly recently in a minor prophets class, so they should be somewhat familiar. They prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. So you have these two guys called out by name by the book of Ezra as being folks who were actively working after the exile during the rebuilding of the temple. So if you want further reading on what their message was, go look at Haggai and Zechariah. And you get to kind of figure out what the problems were of the people that were living in Jerusalem and Judea trying to rebuild during all this time. Haggai, for example, the major point is they were really concerned about how well their homes were made, but they kind of forgot to get back to work on the temple. So the whole rebuke is, you live in beautiful paneled homes, and yet you only look out at the destroyed rubble of the temple, and shouldn't that motivate you to want to finish it up? So get back to work. It's basically Haggai. Okay, verse 2. Then Zerubbabel, the governor, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, arose and began to rebuild the house of God that is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. So you kind of see the book of Haggai was, make sure you get back to work in the temple, and then they did that. So that's good. Verse 3. At the same time, Tattenai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar-Bozenai, which is a great name, and their associates came to them and spoke to them thus, who gave you a decree to build this house and to finish the structure? So you got the main guys coming down from the empire saying, listen, who gave you authorization to do it? And here's the answer. They also asked them this, what are the names of the men who are building this building? But the eye of their God was on the elders of the Jews, and they did not stop them until the report should reach Darius, and then an answer be returned by letter concerning it. So despite the order of them not to rebuild, they did anyway, because God told them to through Haggai. And so they want to know who gave the authority to do this, and the answer basically is, well, God did. And so here's this. Verse 6. This is a copy of the letter that Tattenai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar-Bozenai and his associates and the governors who were in the province beyond the river sent to Darius the king. They sent him a report in which it was written as follows. To Darius the king, all peace. Be it known to the king that we went to the province of Judah into the house of the great God. It is being built with huge stones and timber is laid in the walls. This work goes on diligently and prospers in their hands. Then we asked those elders and spoke to them thus, who gave you a decree to build this house and to finish the structure? We also asked them for their names, for your information, that we might write down the names of their leaders. You know, hint, hint, wink, wink, in case you want some heads to roll. These are the guys who are leading this seditious building of the temple. And this was their reply to us. We are the servants of the God of heaven and earth. And we are rebuilding the house that was built many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and finished. And here's the question for you, I suppose. Who built the temple originally? Pretty easy. Hopefully you know it. Was it King David? No. He asked to build the temple, and first Nathan the prophet said, yeah, sure, go ahead. And then God said, no, stop him, because he's a man of war, a man of bloodshed. I want his son to do it. So Solomon the Great, if you will, built the temple. Okay, verse 12. But because our fathers had angered the God of heaven, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed this house and carried away the people to Babylonia. However, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, Cyrus the king made a decree that the house of God should be rebuilt. And the gold and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple that was in Jerusalem and brought into the temple of Babylon, these Cyrus, the king, took out of the temple of Babylon, and they were delivered to one whose name was Sheshbazzar, who he had made governor. He said to him, take the vessels, go and put them in the temple that's in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be rebuilt on this site. Then the Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundations of the house of God that's in Jerusalem. And from that time until now, it has been in building and is not yet finished. Therefore, if it seem good to the king, let search be made in the royal archives there in Babylon to see whether a decree was issued by Cyrus the king for the rebuilding of the house of God in Jerusalem, and let the king send us his pleasure in this matter. So, again, this is more government speak, right? Official letters sent from people to other official people talking about the authority and who authorized and do you have a contract and do you have a building permit, kind of going along our modern day themes. That's the real issue here. Now, I want to pause and tell you why all this matters, or at least give you some insight into why it should matter. Why do we have this book in the first place? Well, it's not really going to make your spiritual life richer when it comes to application. If you didn't know any of this book of Ezra, could you still make it to heaven? Yeah, you definitely could. So why do we have it? Well, remember at the beginning we talked about who the author might be. The author might be, it makes the most sense, for it to either be Ezra or to be a scribe of Ezra, the guy who's talked about in the book, kind of beginning this process, right? Well, if he is the one who's actually writing this material in the present moment, if he had 1st and 2nd Chronicles written before they left, for example, or if they wrote it soon after they arrived back in Jerusalem, and then you have Ezra and Nehemiah, you have an account of the great transformation of the people of Israel from these group of scoundrels who have been warned for hundreds of years at this point, if they don't repent of their idolatry and their sinfulness and their corruption, then God's going to send them an empire to take them all out. And then they didn't change their ways. And now that they're coming back, they try to do what God told them to do through all the writings of the prophets. They try to keep the law correctly, to be above board, to not worship idols, to be the kind of people that God wanted them to be all along. And so throughout this, you see them behaving in such a way that they're actively trying to be good because God is good. And so you look at this, and it's a lot of names and a lot of details and a lot of letters going back and forth. They are trying to leave this information for later generations to see how hard they tried to do what God told them to do, even despite there being enemies to this work. And so, again, all of that's kind of important historically for us. Through archaeology, we find all these things are to be accurate when it comes to timing and dates and all that. But this is a group of people who've repented, who want to be restored, who want to have salvation, who want to be right with God. And they took the time to get these details in writing for us. So that's a pretty good stopping place for the day, I think. We left off last week talking about there's going to be enemies popping up. Now you know who they are. You know what they've done. They've tried to stop this work from being done because they weren't allowed to to come and help them. So next week we'll have the decree from Darius from the Medo-Persian Empire, and we'll continue on with Ezra and then go on to Nehemiah. So thank you for your attention this afternoon. Hopefully you found it somewhat engaging. I'll see you guys on Sunday and then next week.